The title of my talk is Multi-Level Factors in Participant Retention in Community-Based Health Studies. I have no disclosures to report. So loss to follow-up in longitudinal studies can reduce study efficiency, accuracy, and generalizability, especially when that loss to follow-up is not random or there are differences between the people we're able to hold on to and the people that we lose. Individuals and groups most vulnerable to social inequalities and poor health may also be more difficult to recruit and retain in ongoing studies. And this is not uncommon. Health research is often hampered by poor retention of participants, and that can bias results and lead to inaccurate findings, as I mentioned. This becomes compounded when practice guidelines and health and social policies are based on research, at least we hope they're based on research and evidence, and when that research doesn't adequately retain disadvantaged populations, health disparities can be perpetuated or even increased when results may not apply to disadvantaged populations as much as they do to advantaged populations. So this study was done to look at how characteristics, multi-level characteristics of research participants, but also research studies and the context in which these studies are conducted may act as barriers to participant retention or facilitators of participant retention, because some of the things we're looking at actually make it more likely people are going to stay. And hoping to provide information that investigators and researchers can use in design and implementation of their research projects to develop multi-level retention protocols, but especially to be able to justify allocating these resources when applying for funding. So I did a focus group six focus groups. Three of them were with current and former subjects and also with study dropouts. And three were with study personnel. So it was not just research coordinators and interviewers and PIs, but I actually asked everybody who was involved in the study and had any participant contact if they would come to my focus groups. And I went up to the receptionist in one center and said, "Are you coming to my study?" And she said, "But I'm only the receptionist." And I said, "But you greet everybody who comes in and they tell you about their day and you probably know more about these folks than anyone else here." You know, and she came and it was actually really great to have her. And then I had some people who told me they dropped out of studies and they weren't coming back to that place, so I interviewed them separately. The other thing I should mention is that I made a decision a priori not to collect sociodemographic data, which given my area of research may sound kind of odd. But when I recruited people, I told them, you know, we've been studying you all these years. Now we're going to study us, and you're our key informants and our experts. The other thing is, as you'll see, the differences between the sites were really much more substantial than the differences between the folks. So it was done at three UCSF research centers. One of them was at a hospital setting that did outpatient research and did a lot of general clinical research. The other one was done mostly behavioral research, but some clinical research with subjects generally considered hard to enroll. People who are homeless, marginally housed, marginally employed, recently got out of jail, injection drug users. And this is at a center that is embedded in the community, actually right across Market Street in the Tenderloin. It's really kind of a different world from this part of the town, even though it's like four or five blocks away. And then another center, which was a specialty center that does studies of older adults looking at healthy aging and dementia and cognition. So we recruited this through staff meetings and flyers and word of mouth and cash incentives and the promise of good food. I mention this because some people didn't really want to come to the focus groups at mealtimes. I actually had to promise one center I would make my Grandpa Giocondo's recipe for spaghetti and meatballs that he brought with him from Naples, Italy in 1920. And then they came. But mostly it was catered. So it was a standard qualitative research where inductive data collection and analysis meant that the questions changed as the project went along. So the results were very interesting. I'm not going to go into all of these. As you can see, that I looked at the context, the study, and participant level. There was a lot to do with policy and study design and study implementation. But another thing that came up a lot was relationships, and not just relationships between participants and participants and participants and staff, but also the social contract was mentioned a lot, more than I expected. Someone in one of the centers said, you know, people have been looking at Alzheimer's research ever since Ronald Reagan gave money to it back in 1980. And other people would say, well, I'm in this study because I'm doing my part because society is trying to find a cure for this disease. So the relationship was actually defined in a very broad way. I'm going to go into one example, though, go into some detail for one particular factor. This is transportation. And as you can see, we have, the colors don't look well. This is supposed to be green and the yellow. You can see that there are a lot of overlapping factors, and also that some of the factors in transportation were closely related to other factors that were defined a little differently. I think what I'll just do is give you some quotes from some of the focus groups. So on the contextual level, we had a PI saying, we can barely pay for a parking sticker. After NIH cuts your funding by 20%, you end up with a limited budget. Sound familiar? And you face, well, should I have one less staff person so I can't analyze my data, or should I cut the travel money? And then another study, if it's local, you can pay for a cab or a bus pass. Actually, I can't tell you how many hours it took to figure out how to pay for a bus pass from Chinatown. I don't think we were ever able to do it. And we're talking about Parnassus here, for those of you who are know the city. Also, perceptions of public safety were mentioned a lot in the contextual level, and also the neighborhood where the study took place, because these are three very different neighborhoods, so it was kind of interesting. So one researcher said, you know, our offices are hard to find, and this was within Parnassus, which is like a little rat maze. The better I can give them instructions on how to do that, the smoother that goes, and the less scared they are of coming back in the future. So another person in a different kind of study said, oftentimes they drive like 5 hours to get here. They have to borrow a car from somebody or had to beg and plead for gas money or whatever, and so coming out to visit was huge. Oftentimes, they just didn't come at all. And so being able to help provide some of those resources helped a lot. Another study actually sent somebody to meet someone who had PTSD and was afraid to get on the train. They would have them meet them at the train and accompany them. These people had a lot of money for retention protocols. A study subject said, last time they scheduled an MRI, it was night, and I couldn't come. It sounds kind of silly, but I didn't want to come down there on the bus at night. So you can see that one of the things a study that transportation is related to is study design and flexibility and the ability to really do things so that you can get your research subjects there when they need to come. And then we had folks who said things like, look, it wasn't a problem to get there. We have a car and parking is easy. And that certainly isn't the case with all of the research participants. Another woman in a study of aging said, when I joined, I was working. This woman actually had dropped out of the study. The flight was cheap, and I arranged other things to do, and I was there. Now I have time, but not the money. If they could have paid some of my expenses, I might have stayed. And then I had the folk with the fellow with the PTSD also. So it became clear that the context in which research was conducted was very important, and the characteristics of research participants and studies, and these might interact to affect retention rates in longitudinal studies. Mostly when we look at this, we're looking at what is it about these participants that makes them hard to hold on to. Sometimes looking at, well, what is it that we can do, you know, what is it about our study that will, you know, interact with these hard to get participants and get them to come in. But I actually think that investigators really need to explore multi-level strategies to improve follow-up of all of these participants. And funders really need to be willing to fund it, because it's very, very expensive to do a study that holds on to a lot of people. I was involved in one that had a hard-to-reach population, was very, very difficult to hold on to them, and one of the things that the investigators did was they hired a special employee who had previously been a private investigator, who would kind of follow people around, not follow them around, but find people, and he actually got a lot of folks. So things that we can do in the future, looking at prospective studies, do a prospective study of retention, because if we're going to convince NIH to give us more money for this, they're going to want something more than a focus group study. But also look at population-specific issues, which I was unable to do in my study, and discipline-specific issues, because things seem to vary a lot. Also, look at retention of diverse participants in drug trials. So one of the things I tried to do was get some of the private investigators, the PIs, who were doing industry-funded drug trials to talk to me and let me do focus groups there. One, they didn't want to do that. First of all, there were some good reasons, because you had people taking different drugs. You didn't want them all in the same room to have contaminate, you know, the data, their data. But also, I was told very explicitly, look, this data doesn't belong to me. It's proprietary. It belongs to the drug company. If you think they're going to let you look at it, you're out of your mind. So that was kind of interesting. Also, if we're talking about comparative effectiveness research and patient-centered outcome research, it would be really useful to know who are we including, who are we leaving out, who can we hold on to, and how are we going to really generalize those results. One of the things I'd like to do is develop an interactive tool to assess the risk and reduce loss to follow-up. So you'd put in your study protocols, and you'd be putting in indicators, weighted indicators of whether or not, you know, these tend to be associated with loss to follow-up, and you should be able to, you know, mess around with that a little bit and maybe start to get an idea of where to allocate more resources. So I'm hoping that will be helpful. So this was done only at UCSF. It was a convenience volunteer sample, particularly people who like spaghetti and meatballs came to one of them. And I had limited sociodemographic data by design. But it did provide real-world examples and multiple viewpoints, and I was able to include study dropouts in my study of study dropouts. So I'd like very much to thank the researchers and staff and the study participants. They shared their experience and opinions. Mostly they had a lot of fun. They provided incredible insight. They're hoping to help us do better future research. And this was funded by a RAP grant of UCSF that is funded by NIH. Thank you.